It's the Paddle Woo Podcast.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to the Paddle Woo Podcast. Chase Kosterlitz here, coming to you with my second interview on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the last one with Bart DeZwart. Again, send your feedback. Let me know how you longtime listeners are liking the new perspectives. We will talk about stand-up paddle surfing. Definitely, that is a passion of mine. But having spent 8 years on the race scene and still passionate about it, but definitely not doing it. I'm surfing too much down here in Costa Rica. But having that perspective, I think it's one that is worth sharing, and the people that I'll be interviewing have some great stories, and today is no different. We have Belar Diaz on the show, and Belar is another friend of mine who I've known for about as long as Bart, about 8 years now. And Belar is currently the international brand manager for F1, F1 paddleboards, stand-up paddleboards. F1 also has a kite company that was started, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. And they are in the paddleboard business for about 6-7 years. They've been in for a while as well. So he is an international brand manager living in southern France and commuting to the Canary Islands, where he has a house and tries to spend as much time as he can because he is a passionate surfer like a lot of you guys. So Belar and I talk about his history in racing, but also a lot about surfing, charging big waves on the Canaries. He mentions how he has Jamie Mitchell. Jamie Mitchell is a big wave surfer on the world tour. He has a couple of Jamie's boards that he bought from him. One of them is an 11-0x25 stand-up paddle gun. He talks a little bit about that, but that is quite the dimensions for a board. I don't think I'll be needing anything that big for Costa Rica, but Belar gets into what it's like to surf waves on a board like that, and we talk about foiling. F1 is definitely involved in foiling, and that's kind of all the craze now that we've been seeing in the online videos, and it definitely, I haven't personally tried it, but definitely want to get into it, and I'm sure we'll have a dedicated podcast where we'll really get into the nuts and bolts of foiling and you know, everything about it, because I'm sure a lot of you guys, if you haven't learned, have seen it, and it's something you want to do. I know I want to do it, so stay tuned for that. We also talk about the Euro Tour. If you're familiar with the Euro Tour, it's one of the original tour of stand-up paddle racing, and it's going on its fourth year now, I believe, and it is a collection of the biggest events in Europe. Belar is the creator and operator of that. So if you're looking for an excuse to go to Europe, paddle around, definitely check out the Euro Tour. Belar talks about that. I raced in Europe, I believe it was 4 summers in a row, and it is just a blast, and beautiful races in Italy and Germany and the Netherlands and France, Spain as well. So definitely worth a look. And the surf is good. Even in the summer when I was over there, we had some fun sessions on the coast of France. So yeah, as always, we really appreciate you guys listening. I'm stoked to be having these conversations. It's really fulfilling to me to be able to talk to a lot of these guys and girls that I know, but maybe some things that we haven't really talked about and really dig down, talk about what drives them, what motivates them, their passions for surfing, paddling in general, to give you guys some different perspectives on the paddle community. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Blue Zone SUP. I'm down here roughing it in Costa Rica, and it is just gorgeous. We've been here since the end of October, my wife and 2-year-old daughter, and we are a 5-minute walk from the beach in the main retreat house, Casa Corona. We live at the bottom. There's a studio apartment at the bottom, and my morning ritual when we don't have camp is wake up at 5, do some emails, try to hit the beach right at dawn, and it's unreal how consistent. I don't think it's been below waist high and fun since we got here. Like, there's days when I look forward to just maybe resting my body and not surfing. So I'd love to work with you guys. I've been enjoying the campers coming down, seeing the progression. We just had a guy, Steve, private session for a week last week, and normally we do groups, but Steve had a tricky travel schedule, so it was amazing. And I'll have a video of Steve soon on the Blue Zone site, but he couldn't, and he'll tell you, like, he couldn't really even catch waves at the beginning of the week. I think he had stand-up surfed maybe five times, so, like, he had very little experience. And by the end of the week, we had a great week of waves, and the end of the week, he was consistently catching them, going down the line, and yeah, it was just amazing. And I'm not sitting here, like, trying to take credit as a coach. There's definitely some things I did, but a huge part of it was just having the amazing and consistent conditions that we have here so that every day we can drill and go out one, two times a day, get in good waves, and get him comfortable with positioning and setting himself up for success, and then breaking that down with the video after. So it was hugely gratifying to see such a change in a week. So yep, BlueZoneSUP.com, check it out. Love to have you guys down here. And then also Portal Surf Designs. This is Eric's new passion project, and I'm just thrilled to be involved. As of this year, I'm on board. I don't have an official title. We'll come up with something fun, maybe official ambassador of Stoke or something. But I'm helping Eric a little bit with marketing, definitely with R&D. I have the Barra model down here, and it's just blown my mind. My surfing, everything's faster. My turns are tighter. And I know this sounds super salesy, but I've surfed dozens of boards over the years and through being sponsored, and I've never surfed a custom board, and there's obviously a lot that's going into these designs, Eric's experience, and just the speed, it allows me to do things in surfing that I was doing before, but they just felt forced, and now with that extra speed, I'm able to complete maneuvers, maybe the same ones I was doing, but faster and with more power, and that just feels better and it looks better. So I'm really excited to be on those boards. I've been posting, if you guys follow me on Instagram or follow Blue Zone on our Facebook, I've been posting pictures of a lot of different pictures, but some of me, I've definitely been enjoying my Portal surfboard. So check out portalsurfdesigns.com, and yeah, appreciate you guys listening. Enjoy today's show. All right, Belar, welcome to the Paddle Woo podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, so we have quite the history. Why don't we start there? Or let's start with how you got into stand-up paddling in the beginning, because I'm not sure I know that story. How did you get into stand-up?
I think it was 2008 when I got my first board. I just saw the stand-up, and I've seen it before in California, and I went back to Spain, and I ended up buying one, a used one, and I got in from there. It was quite quick, actually.
And you grew up surfing a bit, so was that kind of the appeal to you?
Yeah. I was moving back. I moved back to Barcelona at the time, and then I was looking for something to be in the water when we have a lot of flat days over there. And stand-up looked like something you could do in flat water and small waves. So I gave it a try, and then from then on, it just went pretty quick.
So that was 2008, and then I think we met, what was it, like 2 years later, 2010? When I went over
yeah,
for the first
2010, I started racing in 2000, the beginning of 2010, and then from then on I started making some international competitions, and I got in Fanatic in 2011. That's when we were on the same team.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it was that year, and that was I went over to Germany for the first Lost Mills, which was at the time like the big event in Europe, and we met there. And it was funny because that was the year that you and Eric Therrien were on like a rampage with the events, right? Like, didn't you?
Yeah, that's the year we did all the events in Europe, and actually that was kind of the unofficial European tour, the first one we did. And we spent about 2 months going all over Europe.
In your van. It, didn't you do like 30 straight weeks or something of races?
Yeah. We raced for those 2 months. We raced every weekend. And then we started doing a couple international events as well. So at the end, it ended up being at the end of the year. It was like 30 straight weeks.
Yeah, which is an insane amount of racing. I remember it was so funny because you guys were like the odd couple, like the Spanish guy. And then if anyone listening knows Eric, he's a great guy, but he's a bit eccentric, a little bit, really solid dude. But you guys were like crammed in this van, just with wetsuits and everything else. Weren't you sleeping in it too? And
at one point, not much. We were mainly getting places, but that's because I told Eric that if we were sleeping in the van, he would sleep in the front seat, and I got the back. We weren't that close.
Well, that was, you mentioned that was the original Euro Tour. So in, I let all of our listeners know your bio and how you are the founder and operator of the Euro Tour, which is pretty amazing. What is it? It's third official year now?
It's the fourth, actually.
Fourth.
We're on our fourth year doing the Euro Tour. We started in 2015. I started kind of as a small collection of events. We did the events in Europe for a couple of years, and then the idea, just we put it together for the 15 season. And then in 16, we really grew it into something bigger with a lot more organization, and 17 was last year, and now 18 will be the fourth year.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty much all the biggest events in Europe, and like you said, starting from that first year we met, 2011, until 2015 when you officially did the Euro Tour, but all those years in between, we were doing the Euro Tour, just we were all piling into cars, and there was Aussies and Jacko and Angie from Once Up, but the guys down there in the Gold Coast, and we would just like hit, you would always do the most events, but I would tag along for about a month here and there. But it's super fun because Europe is so set up so well with these amazing events and amazing countries to just travel in between the events, and now you've just made it a legit and official thing.
Yeah, you know, that's how it started exactly. Like, we were doing those events, and then I realized that transportation was one of the biggest things, you know, in racing. Obviously, there's always been this debate between 12-6 and 14 that now finally seems to be settled, but transporting your board was always a big deal by air. So when we were doing those first few years, I realized that if we had something that had transportation, it would be huge for people, and that's exactly how we started the tour. In 2015, we offered transport in all the events, and that's immediately what clicked out for people, you know, to be able to have that out of the way. Then everything else was a lot easier to organize.
Yeah, it was a great thing for you to do, but we did our own transport before the official tour. I remember one year we had the motorcycle trailer, was it, that we retrofitted?
Yes, and, that's it.
Oh man, that's how it. Many we boards had, did we get
and
on that?
That's how it, and that's how the whole thing started. That we pile up at one point. I think it was 20 boards in a motorcycle trailer. And that's when I realized that that was basically the limit. It wasn't exactly road legal,
or safe.
But we made it, or safe. But we made it, and that's kind of the trigger of the whole tour.
Yeah, I'll see if I can dig up that picture and put it on the website with a link to this episode. Because yeah, it's funny how like those days, those early days, and we look back and it's great now, and it's awesome to have a legitimate trailer and an organized tour, but there's something about those early days when everyone, I don't want to say doesn't care, because we cared, but it was a much more like free and less pressure on the athletes, I feel like, and we were just kind of all winging it back then. Those were good days.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like anything, it starts from the need of people to have something more organized, but the beginnings are always great because that's when you make all the anecdotes, you know. Like you said, if you can pull out that picture of how the Australians were building that trailer out of wood, really.
Yeah.
that we just kind of scrapped together. When you tell people today how much money we have on top of that, on that trailer, nobody would believe you, you know. But that's that was kind of the cool thing, to just kind of the beginning of something.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I haven't been over to Europe the last couple of years, so I'll have to get back to do the official Euro Tour at some point. Even though I'm kind of retiring the race board for now, it's hard to leave the consistent surf of Costa Rica to grind it out on flat water, even if it's somewhere beautiful like the French Alps.
Yeah, I mean, like you know, and that's what we're trying to add variety to the events and make it a bit more about the trip. Like you said, racing has gotten pretty serious. The level these days is quite high, and we always wanted to get the people encouraged to go, not to just say, oh, you know, it's going to be a hard thing to do. It's just, let's go to France, or let's go to Italy, or let's go to Spain, or let's go to Germany, let's go Greece, beautiful places on vacation, and bring the family and kind of do the events. And that's how we're trying to grow the thing into just more of a vacation for people.
Yeah, it's a great format, and hopefully you see some more Americans. It's a little bit of a trip going across the pond, but yeah, any of you guys listening out there, wherever you're from, it's definitely a great way to visit some European countries. And like Bellar said, you just throw your board in the trailer after the race, and next weekend you can race somewhere else. So line up a couple races for a little European summer vacation.
Yeah, that's right. It's definitely worthwhile. And if anybody has any questions about that, they can reach out to the Eurotour, and we can give you guys hints on how to organize your travel. Of course, we're not a travel agency, but it's a lot easier than a lot of people think. So we encourage, yeah, for sure, getting people from overseas.
Yeah, definitely do that. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, you are pretty unique in the industry, having been involved since 2008 in the sport as an athlete for many years, and then now as a brand manager for F1. So you have a unique perspective on being on both sides of the coin, at first starting as a consumer, then as a team rider, and now as managing an international brand. What is the biggest surprise to you now that you're a brand manager, as far as maybe the sport in general or from the business side of things, that people might not understand just as a general consumer or athlete?
You know, there's a lot of talk lately about how the sport is it's slowing down. SUP is not as big as it used to be, and that's because there's a lot of consolidation nowadays. You know, when we started the sport, of course, a ton of brands emerge, and every year you seem like you would go to trade shows and you would see so many new brands and athletes from being sponsored by brands you never heard of and things like that. And there's a bit of consolidation at the moment, so the industry is healthy. The sport is here to stay, and it continues to grow. It's just not growing at the numbers that we were doing the first few years. And a few of the brands are consolidating and being the ones that were here for the short term, for the short run, to try to make a quick profit, and realizing that, you know, like any new industry, once the dust settles, you have to have a plan, a long-term plan with equipment, you know.
Yeah, F1 is definitely an established brand, having started as a kite brand, and I actually knew them from back in the day when I was getting into kiting, and they had kites, and then they soon got into stand up, and so definitely, you know, well established, and with that distribution network that helps coming into the newer sport and for the longevity. Are there any other things, just from a very practical brand manager standpoint, that people, that's kind of behind the scenes, that the average consumer of stand-up paddle boards, whether they're race boards or sup surfboards, might not fully understand, maybe the R&D process or the production process?
Yeah, like you said, like at the beginning, those brands that had a distribution network, we both race for a brand that came from windsurfing. There was many of the big brands came from windsurfing, and they also had those distribution networks that helped them succeed quite rapidly in the industry. The one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that you need that network to be able to reach to the people. You know, it's just to be able to have a successful distribution network and being able to be successful. And within those brands, that we've seen a few of them actually turning away from the sport. It wasn't truly truly working out. So I think from the R&D, those brands that are putting in the effort and the development, and it's not just a race to the bottom on the prices, which is something we've seen the last few years as well. A lot of brands or even factory direct, factories working on direct with consumers, and then just putting up any type of development that's made a race to the bottom. And we've seen big brands, even in the U.S., that were very with a lot of effort into the market, that quickly they just got out as they didn't wait for the long run for the plan. So I think in that sense it's important that whatever brand you work with, whatever you're into, whether it's racing, whether it's surfing, whether it's just touring, there's always a difference between the $400 board and the $1,000 board. It's not just because the brand is trying to make a profit on it, but it's more there's a lot of material, there's a lot of differences on the performance of the product, you know. So that's for sure on the consumer side, what they can actually see and feel quite easily.
Yeah, and the R&D that's going on behind the scenes, and not just a pop out from a factory. So yeah, definitely important to keep in mind. And yeah, it seems like, you know, that is the talk, is that there's a consolidation. And I mean, someone like yourself and myself that's been involved in the industry, this isn't a surprise. Like over the last 4 or 5 years, the market's been flooded with boards, and when supply is more than demand, you know, you're going to have an inevitable consolidation. And that seems like it's finally kind of coming to a head in a real way, that people are feeling it on the ground as far as, you know, brands being sold, brands disappearing. Ultimately, the consumer should be benefiting. Hopefully, they're educated, and not, you know, it's not a benefit if you're getting a crappy China board, you know. So it is important to educate yourself. And then I think things will shake out, and it's not all doom and gloom. I'm sure you're seeing, like with the Euro Tour, like the numbers are probably growing year over year, and there are more people getting into the sport.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, one of the problems that we have is that we've been selling a product to the same people for a few years rather than constantly gaining new people into the sport. And that's something that, especially in the racing community that we both been a very active part, is the biggest thing. If you constantly raise the prices of the equipment, raise the prices of the races, trying to get more prize money for the athletes, but you're not bringing more people into the venue, it's a dead end. You know, at the end, something's gotta give, and that's what's happening right now. You have users that they have 4 or 5 boards at their house, and then they can't really go and have another excuse for the wife or partner and say, you know, can I buy another board? And they're like, no, you've already got like 4 or 5 boards. So we need to get new people into the sport rather than just try to constantly upgrade those users to a new board every year. You know, that's perhaps the one of the things, and especially in racing, that we gotta keep in mind that we need to get new users into the sport. It's not just try to get the latest and greatest from a brand, but it's just also trying to gain new consumers into it.
Yeah, that's a great point, and you're doing the right thing. I like the format of the Euro Tour and highlighting amazing locations and the experience. So it is good work there. Now I want to kind of switch gears here and talk about SUP surfing, and because I know you and I have spent a few winters in Puerto Rico, plenty of surf sessions in Southern California, that SUP surfing is very much how you got into the sport and probably your main passion ahead of racing. Why don't we talk about your time that you were now splitting your time and living in the Canaries and commuting for work to France. Why don't we talk about surfing in the Canaries? I know you guys get some big waves and what that's been like.
Yeah, I mean, subsurfing is funny because it's one of the areas in the sport that a lot of people are seeing the biggest decline and things with subsurfing. I personally love it. I do it all the time. We have the opinion, a lot of the people in the industry that we talk regularly, that we went too small. There was a race to sort of the smallest board possible, and it got to a point that you realized that you were in such a small board that if you can really even paddle the board anymore, you had to lay down and prone paddle the thing. So there's been an evolution on the sport that people have realized that we sort of reached a ceiling as far as size, and it's a very fun part of the sport, and there's a lot of users, but there's certainly a decrease on the activity on the high performance board. I think there's a lot of people that are realizing that when SUP came around, it was the fun thing to do when the waves weren't that great or when to try different spots. And we kind of lost a bit of that perspective. And in the last few years, there's been a push towards like lumber, SUP surfing, and even boards with a bit more length as the average user. Of course, the performance user is still ones that really high performance board, but you're getting more of that feeling that the people that are getting into the sport are wanting something that, you know, they're able to paddle and it floats them, and it, of course it performs good, but at the same time they're able to stand up paddle, which is the definition of the sport. In the Canaries we have great condition. It's kind of like our little European Hawaii, so it's a similar setup and over winter storms, which is quite light surf. So very windy conditions, so it's even more of an area for this type of things that people want a larger craft. Have gone to bigger boards over the last few years to just enjoy the conditions rather than just to paddle. But yes, we have some, especially on the winter months.
Yeah, and can you tell us about some of the spots out there? I know. We used to joke that I have a tendency to find the rocks on the inside, and I know it's all like this gnarly volcanic rock, and it seems a little bit sketchy, and not to mention, you know, there's waves double overhead, triple overhead. What's it like surfing in those kind of conditions?
Yeah, we're lucky, and we have some really good conditions. Our biggest threat is usually the wind. When we get a storm, typically it carries quite a bit of wind, so the difficult thing is to find a shelter spot. Of course, if you want the bigger waves, you're always going to be exposed to the wind. I myself on the last few years have gone to using bigger gun setup type of boards for those conditions, but I've gone quite long and quite narrow. So for the conditions, it seems the boards surf really good, and we're kind of mimicking a bit of the surf big wave industry, that they've gone for quite a bit of length and quite a bit of paddling power to be able to get into them.
Didn't I see a picture of an F1 big wave gun that I saw, I think?
Yes. Yeah, we have one of our ambassadors in California. We made him a gun for Mavericks. He rides Mavericks regularly, and we made him a 9.6 by 21 surf gun. So he
stand
actually
up or prone? Is it a stand up or a prone board?
No, that's a surf board. Yeah, okay. we have a range of boards that are SUP guns, but this in particular it was just a surf gun. Yeah.
Nice. And I remember a few years back, before you were with F1, you bought a board, one of Jamie Mitchell's big wave boards that he's charging on, and it was like something huge, some kind of rhino chaser. Did you get a chance to use that in the Canaries?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've used it a lot. I still do it every once in a while. It's an 11 by 25, and the magic on that board, it was shaped by Sean Ordonez, a famous shaper in Maui, for Jamie, and Jamie is kind of a heavy guy, so he suits me good because I'm not the lightest. And the nice thing about that is to get into the wave, there's no excuse. I mean, with that length on a stand-up, you catch anything.
So it's a stand-up?
It's a stand-up gun, yeah. One is it's a stand-up. It's a stand-up gun made for Joss.
Wow, that thing, yeah, those are quite the dimensions. Do you know the volume on it?
It's actually a little, so it's quite thin, but it's even at 11 foot, and it's only 25 inches wide, so it's, I believe it was like 105 or something on the volume, so it's not that big, but it paddles really, really nice, and really the width of the board, once you get into the wave, it allows you to, it's difficult to move an 11-foot board, because obviously it's quite long, but it allows you to do some really nice things on it, and down the line, it's unbelievable. I actually happen to have a surfboard from Jamie too, that is a 10-6 that I use a lot too, and it has the same feeling. The surfboard is about 30-35 pounds. The stand-up is a bit lighter, but weight is also a big issue in catching the wave and being able to go over the chop, you know, because when it gets really choppy, a light board is actually works against you.
Yeah, and we get some really consistent and good waves here in Costa Rica, and it can have some size, but I don't think I'll ever need a 11-0 by 25 to get into the surf here.
No, but you know, I tell you, one of the boards that I've been surfing this winter that I'm completely in love with is it's a semi gun. It's an 810 by 25, and although it's a bit tricky for my weight, because I'm about 185, 190 pounds. It's and it's a bit low volume. This is 92 liters, so for my weight, it's pretty close. It serves unbelievable. Even if the surf is not that big, the glide on the board, and it for me is fantastic. So even I prefer that rather than my short board that's about 7.9 or 8.0 that I was doing before.
Yeah, it's amazing how if you can go narrow and reduce the volume, you get a lot of performance if the board is made right with the right rocker line and rails. But like you mentioned, with the industry going too small, it's the law of diminishing returns. It's like, yeah, the board might surf great, but if you can't stand on it and catch waves, or maybe you can, but it's a ton of energy and work, then your sessions aren't too much fun.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, one of the other boards that I use the most is a longboard, like a 9 or a 10-foot longboard. And then those, the same thing. You don't maybe go quite as narrow as you would do in a big wave gun, but even you can stay at a width of 26 and 27, and the boards are plenty stable. And even in a smaller day, you have such fun with it. I mean, it's not a board for to be in the pocket, but it allows you to do so many maneuvers and milk the wave all the way.
Yeah, just speed, get out to the shoulder, big carves. Yeah, it's good fun. I definitely recommend people try that. Even if you're like dedicated, you know, shortboard style stand-up surfer, sometimes it's just nice to have a little glide. So you have any sketchy situations with the rocks or big waves out there?
Definitely have some hold downs. The biggest... I'm not using, I use an impact vest under my wetsuit because I don't get into like big size. I mean, size is something, it depends on your scale, I guess, but they're big enough for me. But I always say the same thing. If you're going to go into larger surf, you need to be prepared. You need to know where you're going. You need to have a good entry and exit point on the peak that you're going. And it's not so much with the rocks. I mean, we don't have any sand. All of our stuff is in lava. So the lava is, like you said, is not super friendly, and it's quite sharp if you get into it. But the for the most part, you just get cut in your feet going in and out. So it's not very dramatic. The biggest thing is usually getting caught inside, and then just stumbling with a big board, because the board just takes you for a ride for a while. Yeah. I've had some interesting hold downs for sure.
You're being a little modest because I didn't see it in person, but that picture of you at the secret spot down in Southern California is definitely the biggest wave, stand up or prone, that I've seen a picture of in Southern California. I'm sure it gets bigger, but it was easily like 15, 18 foot face. So you like the big stuff, but yeah, there's a difference. I mean, it's all relative, right? Like big stuff for you and me, we surfed some good days in Puerto Rico, pretty big, but like 18 foot is I'm feeling pretty good. I don't really have a desire to go like 40 foot jaws, but it's amazing. An 18 foot wave can pack a punch.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, like, look, and sometimes I've had the worst wipeouts in smaller waves. You know, not the biggest days are usually the days that you're more alert, so you tend not to get into sticky situations or try not to. And the days that it's a little bit bigger, you tend to push it, and then that's usually when you have the biggest the biggest surprises, you know. So that's I try to train regularly to be on my prone board as the same as a stand up, and you need to really know your limits. Like you said, I mean, there's nowadays you see things in Nazaré and Jaws that most of mortals we want no part on. You know, those waves are unrideable, or they should be unrideable. They're making it work, but they also have huge safety teams behind it. So when people that, you know, get into the bigger stuff, they say, oh, I just need to go and just go for it. You need to have a proper safety team behind. I have this last year, I got a jet ski, and we have some people that, you know, look after you, and that's a very important thing that you need to have. You don't just go out on those massive days with no plan, you know. You have people that that in case something goes wrong, they can take you.
Exactly, yeah, and I imagine you probably charge a little harder when that jet ski's out there too, a little bit of peace of mind.
Yeah, for sure it's a peace of mind. Like you said, I mean, there's the jet skis now. You have the best, of course, that, you know, that they made a huge impact on the big wave surfing. But all that stuff, I think you really need to know your limits and your training. You know, what we consider a big wave, like I said, these professional athletes, that's all they do, guys like Jamie, that they train their entire year for it. I mean, they're professionals on this. So we, you know, even if you think you can do it, I mean, you need to really dedicate yourself to have the ability or the opportunity to even go. So don't think it's just a matter of, oh, it's big, I'll just go out and see what happens. There's a jet ski, or I have a vest, I'll be okay. I mean, there's a lot that goes behind it, that these guys train really, really hard for it.
Yeah, it's important to keep in mind. And switching gears again a little bit here, I want to talk about, you mentioned earlier you've traveled and raced and surfed around the world. What are the biggest difference you see, and you've spent a ton of time, probably more than any paddler, on the European scene and in the U.S. scene. What are the biggest differences between like subsurfing in Europe and in the States, and then we can talk about racing as well, that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely different, like in the States in general, people like use bigger equipment, and it's not a problem to have stand-up. The thing in Europe, we have a very high percentage of inflatables. We have countries like Germany, which is like 80-90% of inflatables. Of course, that's they have less of a subsurfing market, but for the most part, people go to the smaller boards because they live in apartments, and the living situation is not the same. And then you don't have access to be able to store those big boards. So the size of the boards is one thing, and also the culture, I would say, in Europe in for the most part is a bit closer to surfing in certain spots. You definitely have spots like Northern California in the state where it's very surfy oriented, and then people are less likely to go subsurfing. But in Europe, for the most part, like the culture was surfing, and when stand-up came around, if it was in places like the Mediterranean, which it was a bit more open, there's probably a bit less, like the Basque Country, Northern France, lands, all that stuff. It's a bit closer into surfing. So subsurfing is not, it's kind of like the ugly, the ugly stepchild or whatever you want to call it. People do it, and certainly if you surf and you subsurf, it's not the problem, but there's probably a bit more of a culture not for subsurfing, so you see it a bit less. It's still a bit more uncommon. Or even in Portugal, you can go and you see a lot less subsurfing than you would in other places.
Yeah, it's interesting. Every beach kind of has its own culture too. Like definitely Europe and the States have some differences as far as when it comes to subsurfing. But, you know, having been down here in Costa Rica, it's been quite refreshing to see how it's not everyone and there are detractors, but it's pretty accepted. You know, that stand-up surfing in the lineup, obviously it helps, like we talk about on the show, and to practice good etiquette, to not be a wave hog. But you can go to a place and sit on your stand-up board and not, you know, be super friendly, but you'll still get the stink eye real hard because just the culture of that area is that beach is maybe a little bit hardcore, and or maybe they've had a problem in the past, which never helps. But you know, particularly down here in Costa Rica, and it doesn't hurt to. And one of the beauties of stand up that I know you like is to be able to find your own peak and surf away from the crowds and by yourself and down here and even in Southern California, but certainly down here in Costa Rica, I prefer. There's a fair amount of sessions where it's just me or my campers or a few friends and no one else in great waves. And even in San Diego, where there's like feels like hundreds of thousands of surfers, we were able to like go to places, I'm not going to say the name, but and just kind of be by ourselves on the stand-up boards.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that the topic is always like, look, yeah, foiling right now, which is a whole nother topic on it, and it's even more delicate, but there's always places that you can find. It's just a matter of everybody trying to be in the same wave. You know, there's places that you know you've got a lot of people in the water, so why try to go with your stand-up board when you know you're going to be too close to prone surfers? You know, I mean, you can always find a place, and in most places, I agree, you can surf. I mean, I've subsurfed in Brazil in some of the most local places in Rio, and they told me, no, don't you dare go in a stand-up, and you go into, you find your own wave, and you sit down, you relax, you talk to people. There's always a chance, there's always a wave. It's just a matter of education. If you have the right etiquette, you can go anywhere. The problem is when you have five stand-ups and they just start taking every wave in the lineup. So of course you're not making any friends there. But it's all a matter of education.
Yeah, we're gonna Eric and I are gonna record a show hopefully soon that'll just be us chatting about kind of the etiquette in the lineup, but some things that I've noticed that aren't traditional surf etiquette because it's so unique that we have a paddle. But like, for example, paddling to the peak. So like, even if there's only a few surfers, I see sometimes we'll paddle because we have the advantage of standing. Someone on a stand up, I've seen they'll paddle out to the peak and then like turn and take the wave. And now, generally, technically they're in position and they haven't dropped in on anyone, but it's just a bad look, and it's kind of an unfair advantage that there's no reason to do, and it just kind of we'll do some video with that too because it might be a little bit abstract what I'm talking about. But yeah, having that etiquette, and when you were talking about the place in Brazil, it reminded me of that session. We had a session in Puerto Rico where one of the local guys was giving us, was hassling us, but then by the end of the session, we were like best friends. You remember that?
Yeah, of course. And it's all about like the way you approach it. Like, you're right. Like, you know, you can go out and huge advantage when we're paddling on top of a board that we see the set coming, so we can outposition a surfer at any point, you know. So you should take that into account, and then you cannot try to outrun the surfer, because you're always going to be able to do it. You're standing up and you're seeing what's coming, you know, which is, it's a great advantage for the subsurfer, but at the same time, you have to be conscious of other people in the water. At the same time, there's when, for example, on the bigger days, that can be a really nice advantage, and people actually like having a stand-up out, because you can tell people there's a set coming, hey, let's go to the right, let's move over, you have a greater visibility on it. So there's advantages, certainly, that you can have with a sub that doesn't have to be always, you know, you don't always have to be the, I mean, if you conduct yourself, like you say, in a proper way, at the end, any apprehension that a lot of people have, by the end of the session, if you've been polite, a lot of people, and they see that you know what you're doing, which is also another thing. Once people see that you know what you do, you can control your equipment, then they relax, because one of the biggest things that a lot of prom surfers have, which with good reason, is that a sup is a big board. So if you let go, you cannot duck dive on a sup. So if you let go on a board, you can hurt somebody if you don't know how to control it. So it's always trying to go away from people, trying to go back out of the lineup in a proper way. So there's a lot of factors, like you said, that it's best. I think it's a great idea that you guys do that, because a lot of people don't do it on purpose. They simply just don't know any better.
Yeah, exactly. It's not on purpose. And yeah, Eric and I are going to do maybe even a couple deep dives on this, because I think it's an important issue. And you mentioned on the bigger days, like calling waves, that's a great way to be in the lineup and quote, make friends with the surfers. And just a couple of weeks ago, we had one of the bigger swells since I've been here, and it was, maybe double overhead on the sets. And it was actually I had some of the best waves of my life. And, but one of the best moments was there was a set coming. I was standing and I had a few surfers around me, and, you know, I whistled to them and I pointed, and cause they were way on the inside, and they got the notice, they paddled out. And there was just two of them by me. One of the guys, it was a split peak, and it was maybe like couple feet overhead, barreling wave. One guy went left, the other went right, and they both like had really long rides. And it was like, it was pretty funny, because had this great session, but it was like really gratifying for me to have done that. And like the guy scored, and one of them came back out and was like, hey, thanks for the heads up. But it's funny how like that kind of made my session.
Yeah, no, and you can do that. I mean, like when you see a set coming, you can, in a stand up, a lot of times you can tell there's like a two or three waves, so you can look around you and see how many people are in position. And of course, there's you know your place, you know when you got there what your position is. But even if it's your turn, even if it's your wave, don't just go and take the first wave, you can call it and let people in, and then there's always another wave for you behind it. And that people appreciate that, and the tension that they might have, the apprehension they might have against you, once you do that, it changes completely, you know?
Yeah, I always say, just because you can take every wave doesn't mean you should. So
right.
Yeah. Well, so I want to finish up and talk about, you mentioned it, and I know F1 is getting involved in it, and that is foiling. So this is kind of like the trending thing. We're seeing all these videos. It looks amazing. I actually haven't even tried it. I'm going to get into it probably this summer. But why don't you talk about, because I know you've personally got into it kind of recently, and then as a brand, what your perspective on foiling is.
Yeah, I mean, foiling is not just the latest trend. I mean, it's really becoming a whole new sport, and there's a lot of people going into it, and especially within the surf community, which is a much bigger community than the stand-up community. It's really having a lot of people getting into it, and a lot of people advocate. Even the guys from the big wave community, pro surfers, you're seeing a lot of familiar faces getting into the sport. And here in F1, we've been involved in foiling since the beginning. So we've been pushing for it for quite a while, and now our focus is on surf, because surf foiling is the new thing. As you can, a lot of you that have probably seen foiling, you notice that the guys are getting into it with smaller and smaller boards. That's because once you're flying, you really don't need much of a board. So it there's definitely a whole equipment progress that is super rapid, like any new sport. But we're full for it, and at F1 we've got one of the very recognizable names, Grant Twiggy Baker, big world champion from last year, that is it's part of our team now and is collaborating with us. And the thing with foil, it's even more than stand-up. I mean, imagine for those of you that don't know what a foil is, it's basically a wing underneath the water doing all the lifting the board. And those wings are made out of carbon fiber, and they're, you know, if you were to hit somebody with it, it's a dangerous thing. So the beauty of it is that you can do this when there's barely any waves. So a lot of the people that are doing this, they're going into foiling when you don't have any waves, when you can surf any waves. So that's the very nice thing about the sport, that it opened yet another possibility. Like, even when you have waves that are small, too small for a stand-up to even catch, you can catch them on a foil, whether it's a surfboard or SUP foil. And even waves that never even break in an open ocean, you can do that as well. So it's a whole new sport that is really getting a lot of people into. I personally been getting to it myself lately, and the sensation of flying, it's, people tell you about it and you say, okay, yeah, it looks good. You know, I see Kyle Lenny doing this thing and it looks pretty cool, but maybe it's just because it's him and he's so good at it. But once you fly for the first time, you're hooked. And that's the thing that I think is getting so many people, that, you know, you're flying over the water, basically not hearing anything. So it's like you hear a small whistle of the board just flying over. So it's very unique sensation.
Yeah, it looks amazing. And so is it harder than it looks, easier than it looks? What's the learning curve like?
You know, you need, unlike other sports, this is really something that you need for teacher for it. Like I said, the equipment can be very, very dangerous. So foiling, it's not dangerous. But if you don't know what you're doing, it can be quite dangerous. So that's the one number one thing that you have to be watching out for. Then you know that you have somebody properly showing you. And once they show you, it's actually not that difficult. Surf foiling is perhaps it is more difficult than SUP foiling. Windsurf foiling is, everybody says, is actually the easiest part of foiling. And of course, if you're a kiter, kite foiling, it's also not too complicated once you are a kiter, but in the sport itself, you really need the proper way. Like as you've probably seen, most people get started by being towed behind a boat, and then with that having the sensation of flying, controlling that being boat, kind of like in water skiing, but in a very slow way, because you only need like 4 or 5 knots to really fly behind a boat. So that's the number one thing, that if you're going to do this, you need to learn it the right way, because it can be quite a handful if you don't.
Yeah, I'm going to get behind a boat and I look forward to feeling that flight. I know I'm going to be hooked. That'll be the next adventure. And well, I want to wrap up here, and I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, we lived together for a few months at a time in the past, and saw each other pretty often. It's been too long at this point. You're talking about maybe coming down to Costa Rica, so Sarah and I.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's definitely something I want to take you up on. And why wouldn't somebody want to go to Costa Rica? I mean, you guys have like perfect surf all the time. You know, it's not really windy, it's warm. I mean, the Costa Rican people are super nice. I mean, it's not a hard thing to something too hard to come up with.
Yeah, you didn't have to sell it, but I appreciate it. it is a great place, and yeah, hopefully our paths will cross soon. Why don't you tell people where they can find more information on the Euro Tour and F1, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Yeah, you guys, if you have any questions about the Eurotour, you can go to our website, eurotoursup.com, and you can see all the events, and feel free to, our contact information is in there. And for F1, you have f1sup.com or f1foil as well, that you can see all the products and stuff that we have.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on the show, Bellar.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
It's the Paddle Woo Podcast.